2020 titled Tackling Financial Flows for Substantial Development in Africa. The report shows that every year an estimated $88.6 billion, which is equivalent to 3.7% of Africa's GDP, leaves the continent in the form of illicit financial flows. Illicit financial flows are movements of money and assets across borders which are illegal in source, transfer, or use. The source of this cash is mainly corruption, criminal activities, tax evasion, and transfer mispricing.
The report by United Nations Conference on Trade and Development includes alarming information on how Africa loses billions of dollars yearly as a result of these illicit financial flows. It also highlights the impact of such losses on the development of the continent. UNCTAD Secretary General Mokhisa Kituyi says illicit financial flows rob Africa and its people of their prospects.
Countries with the high illicit financial flows are demonstrably less productive in agriculture than those with more control on illicit financial flows. Countries with high illicit financial flows invest about 25% less in health, 58% less in education than comparable countries on the continent.
The UNCTAD report has mentioned some examples of illicit financial flows. For instance, Angola lost $60 billion through capital flight between 1986 and 2015. In Nigeria, oil export misinvoicing cost the country $44 billion, and import misinvoicing led to a loss of $45 billion between 1996 and 2014. Zambia's net export misinvoicing of copper led to losses amounting to $14.5 billion from 1995 to 2014.
Addressing a high-level virtual meeting last December, the UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed said, at a time when Africa is mobilizing resources for pandemic recovery and sustainable development, illicit financial flows are robbing the continent billions of dollars. Let's take a listen.
At a time when Africa is trying to maximize domestic resource mobilization, it's losing $50 billion a year to illicit flows. And that probably is not an estimate that is anywhere near the reality. These staggering losses would be enough to fill 75% of the continent's health financing gap. They would more than be what is needed to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal on Inclusive Education, SDG 4. And they are one third of what Africa needs annually to fund infrastructure projects.
Now, for more on these, we contacted Peter Fabricius, who is a consultant with the Institute for Security Studies. We also have Dr. Carlotta Schuster, an economist with the Division for Africa and Least Developed Countries at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. She's also one of the authors of the UNCTAD report on tackling financial flows for sustainable development in Africa. Thanks a lot for your time. Let's start off with Dr. Schuster. Now, can you briefly elaborate on the report you co-authored?
First of all, let me thank you for giving the opportunity to speak about UNCTAD's research on illicit financial flows. In the report, we define illicit financial flows as cross-border flows of money or goods that are illicit in origin, transfer, and use. Since extractive commodities matter for the continent, as they constitute more than 60% of total African exports and 30% of GDP, getting returns right is crucial for fostering sustainable development. The report estimates that the continent has lost at least $220 billion linked to the export of extractive commodities since 2010, and that high-value, low-weight commodities like gold, diamonds, and platinum are the main drivers.
Thanks for that introduction, Dr. Schuster. Now, how have these illicit financial flows impacted on ability by countries to combat poverty and develop?
Illicit financial flows are a global problem, but socioeconomic costs are especially high in Africa. Countries with high illicit financial flows spend on average 58% less on education and 25% less on health. In some countries, illicit financial flows linked to the extraction of natural resources have an unquantifiable multiplier effect, where they undermine peace and security and finance conflict. which is extremely costly in terms of people's prosperity, poverty reduction, and sustainable development.
Thanks for that, Dr. Shusa from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development.
According to iWatch Africa website, multinational tech companies such as Google and Facebook operating legally across Africa pay substantially lower taxes as a result of obsolete tax rules. Why are African countries not doing enough to stop or reduce illicit financial flows which take place by exploiting local legal loopholes?
It's difficult because a lot of these tax practices are not illegal. And I mean, you know, the OECD and the G20 and so on have been working quite hard to make them illegal, or at least to discourage governments from doing that. And they're having some success, but clearly not enough, because I think a lot of foreign jurisdictions derive too much profit from them. A lot of little, you know, tax haven countries, territories of Britain or US or whatever, sort of depend quite heavily on them. And then, of course, there's just corruption. You know, I mean, there's guilt on both sides.
As you mentioned there, cash stolen from Africa mostly ends up in Western financial institutions. Now, why is enough action not being taken by the United States and major European governments to stop their territories from being a destination of these illicit financial flows?
But they're clearly not enough. You know, the Panama Papers and so on have shown that there's still a huge amount of money that is moving clandestinely, at the very least, if not blatantly illegally, from all over the world. But let's say we're talking about Africa, from Africa and other developing parts of the world largely to banks in the developed world. And so it's clearly something that's difficult to combat, because it's profitable to a lot of banks and a lot of jurisdictions. And so, you know, sustained effort is needed to combat it.
As we saw earlier in the program, Nigeria is among the African countries mostly affected by illicit financial flows. The country is currently ranked 146th out of 180 countries in the 2019 Corruption Perceptions Index. War on Corruption has not achieved a significant milestone in the overall prevention of corruption in the country. The country's Vice President, Oluyemi Osinbajo, last year warned that the illicit financial flows out of Africa also undermine the foundations of democracy.
They undermine the foundations of democracy and provide the financial incentives for terrorist activities and fuel conflicts on the continent.
Mr. Fabricius, you earlier mentioned that illicit financial flows are a two-way traffic and that some African officials are involved. How can you elaborate?
You looked at some of the reports that have been done by other institutions, like the late Kofi Annan's institution a few years ago, where what was happening in a country like the DRC, and I don't know if it still is, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where what was happening is that the state-owned enterprises, often mining enterprises, were selling off their minerals at ridiculously low prices to private entrepreneurs, who were then selling them on to, you know, at the real market value. And clearly what was happening there was that those private business people, foreign business people, mostly, I guess, we're giving huge kickbacks to get people in government, including probably right up to the top, you know.
What needs to be done to end these illicit financial flows?
This is a very good question. The Economic Development in Africa report proposes a 10-point plan to tackle illicit financial flows. At the national level, better customs enforcement, better geological information, and increased transparency around resource contracts will allow to increase revenue. At the regional level, information sharing between countries and unifying markets through the African Continental Free Trade Agreement is another avenue that allows countries to exert their power in international commodity markets. At the international level, better cooperation on international taxation and reducing harmful tax competition between countries allows to curb illicit financial flows further. Illicit financial flows are a shared problem between developed and developing countries, and curbing them requires global solutions.
Mr. Fabricius, you have the last word. Western countries clearly need to take measures to stop their jurisdictions from being used as a haven for looted African cash. On the other side of the coin, what should African governments do to tackle this problem of illicit financial flows?
Is that African countries have to improve their ability to conduct revenue collection at home. Very few African countries actually have efficient and capable tax administrations. You know, in a way, this continent has become so addicted, if you like, or habituated to foreign aid that it just hasn't had the motivation in many cases.
Tackling corruption and functional revenue collection are key factors in tackling illicit financial flows in Africa.
West dumps e-waste in Africa.
E-waste is used electronic items that are nearing the end of their useful life and are discarded or given to be recycled. The rapid modernization, industrialization, and consumer appetite for better products has exacerbated e-waste management challenges. Several African countries have become the world's largest dumping grounds for electronic waste from Western countries. This e-waste dumping has created a deadly industry that has put thousands at risk.
If I see different way, this one is we are suffering for here because the heat is there. Where the smoke will disturb us. So if you see good work, we will go join it and leave this one.
E-waste dumping is actually a continuation of waste colonialism, where high GDP Western countries in Europe and North America were accessing African land for inexpensive disposal of waste. They were using Africa and primarily countries in the Gulf of Guinea, especially Nigeria, Ghana, and Ivory Coast, as a dump for their toxic waste.
For an incisive analysis on this, we have contacted Nimo Basay, an environmental activist, author, and director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Our first question, now despite all the hype about protecting the environment, it appears Western countries do not really care or others, as they are now dumping electronic waste in Africa. What's your take?
Unfortunately, when it comes to environmental health and dumping of waste around the world, Africa is seen basically as a dumping site. So Africa usually is seen as a storehouse for exploitation, but it's also seen as a place to dump waste. And the act of dumping toxic waste in Africa, e-waste in Africa, is not accidental. It's actually economically propelled. It's also a deliberate political action. In 1991, a chief economist in the World Bank said that it made economic sense to dump toxic waste in Africa because Africa is vastly under-polluted. When we have that line of thinking at that level of global governance, then we can see that what is happening across the continent is a very deliberate act, and it needs a deliberate pushback.
Thanks for that, Nimo Bose, environmental activist from Nigeria, and stay tuned for more.
From the start of this country, we haven't had really any answer for the electronic waste that we produce, talkless of the electronic waste that gets dumped on us from outside.
Why have most governments in the Gulf of Guinea region failed to stop their territories from being used as dumping ground for hazardous waste?
The sad situation is that some of our regulators are not really focused on what they ought to be doing, and they get carried away by other things, and they're not paying attention to ensuring that the environment is not damaged this way. We have regulators who believe that accepting some of these waste is kind of economically viable. It brings some resources into the country. They're looking for how to generate revenue, and they keep a blind eye to the dumping of this dangerous e-waste on the continent, especially Nigeria and Ghana, as you mentioned.
Speaking at the launch of our National Integrated E-Waste Management Program in 2018, President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana noted that the downside of the ICT revolution has meant the production of high volumes of electronic and electrical wastes.
E-waste is a major global problem and one of the top environmental challenges of this, our 21st century. Indeed, many of the ICT equipment imported into the country, as we say in Ghana, are secondhand. Most of these products are imported illegally in contravention of regional and international laws, such as the Bamako Convention, the Basel Convention, and EU waste shipment regulations. It is in line with this responsibility that the Hazardous and Electronic Waste Control and Management Act, Act 917 of 2016, has been passed. Today's launch, ladies and gentlemen, marks the initiation of two key provisions of Act 917, which are critical to the successful implementation of this new law.
According to the UN Environment Agency, Nigeria now ranks alongside Ghana as one of the world's leading destinations for electronic waste. The country received 71,000 tons of used consumer goods through the two main ports in Lagos, from the European Union and other more industrialized economies every year. Nigeria is an attractive destination for waste exporters, partly due to the limited enforcement of import restrictions and other regulations. Do we have adequate international regulations to stop e-waste dumping in Africa?
Again, as is usual with many environmental issues, sometimes it's not really the lack of regulation that makes it impossible to take care of the environment. It's actually a lack of willingness to protect the environment and protect the people. We have in Africa, for example, the Bamako Treaty, which ought to be endorsed by every country. I'm not quite certain if Nigeria has endorsed as at this time. As at last year, late 2019, they hadn't endorsed it. This is a treaty that would have protected the country from dumping of toxic waste, but
Ghana is said to have the largest informal recycling industry in Africa and imports some 40,000 tons of e-waste annually. There are several homegrown initiatives in the country to deal with the e-waste problem. A social entrepreneur and artist, together with his friends, have been turning e-waste from the sprawling dumping ground in Ghana's capital Accra into high-end furniture made by the people working in the dump.
It's true that Abubakar is the result of negative externalities from, you know, dumping by more developed European countries, but I chose to see the opportunity within the mess. You know, I chose to see the opportunity to create and turn what has been called a dump into an opportunity.
Still in Ghana, an NGO known as the Green Advocacy is working to improve the situation for workers at the Iwe site with machinery that strips the wires of their kerosene.
So since 2009, we had this idea of setting up some kind of pilot recycling center to help the people here stop burning. So a customer comes in with a piece of cable, we just take it through this end, it goes the other way, we get the plastic, they take their metal. So it's like really fast, no issues, you just walk in, you pay your 50 pesos, that's it.
While such initiatives are an artistic way of solving this e-waste problem, they quite clearly cannot provide a lasting and substantial solution to the challenge posed by this hazardous waste. What immediate action needs to be taken to save Africa from further dumping of hazardous waste by former colonial powers?
I believe the first step is actually to decolonize the continent. We're still running a new colonial system that listens too much to the former colonial masters. And this overbearing influence of the colonial powers, the imperialist powers on the African political system. And then, of course, we need to fight against poverty.
Mr. Basse there believes that Africa needs to eradicate neocolonialism to stop the destruction of the continent's environment and preserve it for future generations. What do you think? Do let us know your views through our social media handles. That's all we had for you in today's edition. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, thank you for being with us. Take care and God bless you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. And I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, True Asceticism. There were Sufis who adopted and promoted as a solitary goal of existence excessive abstinence from the worldly delights, frugality, and voluntary poverty. they upheld that the source of all goodness in this world and in the hereafter was in having little or nothing, and in withdrawal from people, while the source of all evil in this world and in the hereafter was in having much and in mixing with people. They, as a result, denied themselves many types of permitted food, drink, clothes, and many other legitimate worldly delights, sometimes to the extent of becoming so frail that they were unable to perform basic errands. Some event went beyond mere bodily torture almost to the extreme of self-immolation. They refused to possess virtually anything, but often had to depend on other sources for their scant provisions, irrespective of whether those sources came from their family members, friends, or even government officials. In short, such people observed strict corporeal, abject poverty, erring not as much in the aims and objectives as in means and methods. The whole operation, instead of enriching them spiritually, in the end impoverished them even further, both physically and spiritually. So this is what some Sufis ended up doing, which was wrong. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the true asceticism, and we gave you a description of what some Sufis and their ideology had them do when it comes to asceticism. Just because they understood it wrong, they went down a path that led to their physical and spiritual poverty. Now, there is nothing virtuous in coveted excessive asceticism, poverty, and passivism, basing them on God's will and believing that nothing can and should be done about it. Those Sufis articulated several traditions of the Prophet to the effect that poverty was Allah's preference, and it was a source of the pride of the Prophet, who always found much gratification in it. But those traditions are plain forgery, as Islam in no way encourages deliberate excessive asceticism, poverty, and passiveness. This passivism and this poverty, which is self-inflicted, this is not the way of Islam. Certainly, Islam sees neither affluence nor poverty as inherently either good or bad. Islam sees potential goodness as much in affluence as in poverty. Just as it sees potential evil as much in affluence as in poverty. Consequently, the Prophet sought refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from the evil of the trial of the affluence, and from the evil of the trial of poverty, as well as from the evil of debt. So remember, brothers and sisters, in your life, Islamic asceticism is very clearly defined, and it is not the path of the deviants, which completely abandoned the world and which did not fulfill their responsibilities. Be responsible, be spiritual. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
the limelight.
As Tennessee, like other states, embarks on the daunting task of inoculating millions of residents against COVID-19, many health officials find their mission complicated by a pervasive mistrust of government and law enforcement among unauthorized immigrants, a population estimated at 11 million across the U.S., says Sarah Varney, correspondent, in an article published under the heading Anti-Immigrant Racism Complicates COVID-19 Vaccine Rollout in South U.S. Stay tuned for more. In eastern Tennessee, doctors have seen firsthand how a hardline immigration policy can affect the health and well-being of a community. In 2018, federal agents raided a meat packing plant in Morristown, a manufacturing hub in the Tennessee Valley, and detained nearly 100 workers they suspected of being in the country illegally. In the weeks that followed, scores of immigrant families who had found work in meat processing plants dotting broader Hamble County scrambled to find sanctuary in churches and avoided seeking medical care. The reason? Immigration agents were staking out clinics. We did not want people to come in for care because there were IC officers in packing lot, said Parsinda Khatri, chief clinical officer at Cherokee Health Systems, a nonprofit provider in Hamble County. As Tennessee, like other states, embarks on the daunting task of inoculating millions of residents against COVID-19, many health officials find their mission complicated by a pervasive mistrust of government and law enforcement among unauthorized immigrants, a population estimated at 11 million across the U.S. The challenges are particularly acute in southern U.S., where large populations of immigrants living there illegally help maintain the region's thriving agricultural and food processing industries, even as many state and local Republican leaders, emboldened by the Trump administration's 4 years of anti-immigrant vitriol, denounce unauthorized residents as criminals and call for more limited paths to citizenship. The confluence of those aggressive attitudes and a highly contagious virus has prompted concerns in some states that lackluster vaccination of people in the country without legal permission will short-circuit efforts to achieve herd immunity for the broader community. We will never get on top of this pandemic if the undocumented are left out, said Sharon Davis, chief medical officer at Las Berrias Unidos Community Clinic in Dallas, which serves 28,000 patients, the majority of them in the country without authorization. She acknowledged the challenge that poses in a state such as Texas, where the state Republican Party platform calls for the immediate expulsion of all illegal aliens. Echoing clinic directors in many southern states, Davis said, rolling out vaccination plans in immigrant communities is a don't ask, don't tell policy. Davis was among the medical directors who said the mass vaccination sites many states are using in the rollout
giant tents staffed by uniformed National Guard troops and iPad-toting medical personnel have spooked immigrant families. They are asking, what documentation do we have to show at the mass vaccination sites, said Davis. Fear of deportation is just huge and very real. And not unfounded, advocates noted, coming up 4 years in which former President Donald Trump sharply curtailed both legal and illegal immigration through mass detention and deportation, travel bans, and severely restricting asylum. President Joe Biden has pledged to undo many of Trump's policies, but immigrant advocates say support for more drastic measures runs strong among some immigration agents and local law enforcement officers who could make life difficult for immigrants they suspect are in the country illegally. Beyond fear of harassment or arrest, Davis said, public health officials are dealing with misinformation, including widespread rumors about government surveillance efforts secreted in the vaccine. They're hearing horrible stories on social media, she says. They believe there was a microchip in the vaccine and they would be tracked. Even some immigrants living in the U.S. legally have reservations about receiving a government-provided vaccine. The Trump administration pushed to derail citizenship for any immigrant who used taxpayer-funded public services, including health care. In December, the Department of Justice withdrew the rule, but confusion abounds, and clinic directors say patients will prioritize their green cards above almost all else. Sluggish vaccination rates among immigrant populations are already apparent. In Mississippi, for example, the Department of Health reported last week that fewer than 2,800 Latinos have been vaccinated, about 1% of all vaccinations administered so far. Tennessee offers a prime example of the tensions underlying the vaccine rollout. The Republican governor, Bill Lee, made headlines in May when he allowed the State Department of Health to share the names and addresses of those who tested positive for the virus with police. The city of Nashville's health department separately provided local police with the addresses of people who tested positive or were quarantining. Both efforts came under criticism and eventually ended, but Lee defended the effort, saying the information was appropriate to protect the lives of law enforcement and permitted by federal health privacy laws. The city later sought to reassure its diverse immigrant communities that the information would not be shared with federal immigration authorities. Alabama, like Tennessee, has a history of tough rules regarding immigration, including a sweeping 2011 law that bars unauthorized immigrants from receiving nearly all public benefits, including most non-emergency medical care. Velvet Luna, a 26-year-old registered nurse, has built her life in Ozark, Alabama, a small city in Wiregrass, a region known for its poultry processing facilities and large populations of Hispanic and Vietnamese immigrants. Luna enrolled in Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, an Obama-era program that granted temporary status to unauthorized immigrants brought across the border as children. According to the National Immigration Law Center, nearly 500,000 DACA-eligible immigrants are essential workers. Luna, who speaks with a soft southern accent, once freely shared her immigration status, said, in recent years, men who worked with her would find out my status and would immediately change their attitude toward me. They would say ugly, ugly, hurtful things. You are the reason the U.S. is declining. You need to get out of here. As a nurse at an area hospital who volunteered in the COVID unit, she has received both doses of vaccine, but she understands the risks undocumented families weigh. Neither of her parents, who live close by, are authorized to be in the U.S. It's okay to be scared, and it's a courageous move to go get the vaccine and protect your family, she said. Even hardline immigration opponents acknowledge the pandemic has tied together the fates of everyone living in the U.S. regardless of how they arrived. The main thing is to get shots into as many people's arms as possible. Mark Kerkorian, executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a conservative think tank that strenuously advocates for restricting immigration, said. He added, "Your immigration may catch up with you someday, but that's not today." The Biden administration has said U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement will not conduct enforcement operations at or near vaccine distribution sites. IC does not and will not carry out enforcement operations at or near healthcare facilities such as hospitals, doctor's offices, accredited health clinics, and emergent or urgent care facilities, except in the most extraordinary of circumstances, according to a February 1st statement issued by the Department of Homeland Security. State health commissioners also have tried to calm rattled nerves. "We're not denying vaccine to anyone who shows up at our sites and is in a phase," said Dr. Lisa Pearsley, commissioner of the Tennessee Department of Health. "This is a federal resource, and if you're in this country, then you get a vaccine." Advocates, however, said hurdles remain in convincing very immigrants that the personal information collected as part of the vaccination process will not be used against them. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention expects providers administering COVID vaccines to upload patient information to state registries, including 10ISS in Tennessee or IMTRACE2 in Texas. The tracking systems allow providers to ensure patients return for their second dose and to identify any adverse reactions. The use of such information for health initiatives, not immigration crackdowns, is a nuance that providers struggle to explain. Patients, particularly those of immigrant origin, are highly sensitive to sharing family details. Brian Hale, executive director of Neighborhood Health, a community clinic in Nashville, wrote to Tennessee health officials in December. "If we ask them to provide this information to providers they do not know, they will be even more reticent to have their families get vaccinated."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Policy. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
A few points about the Barjam, JCPOA, and the reductions in the commitments of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Another issue which is discussed frequently by officials, the people and politicians in cyberspace and in other podiums is the issue of the Barjam, JCPOA, and the Islamic Republic's commitments. Recently, the Islamic Republic announced that it has withdrawn from some of these commitments. Lately, it has also begun the 20-person enrichment process and the administration implemented the bill ratified by the Majlis. This is one of the issues that is discussed frequently today. I wish to raise 2-3 points about the issue of the Barjam. America's return to the Barjam. The first point is a discussion about whether the US should return to the Barjam or not. We do not at all insist on this, and we are in no rush for the US to return to it. Our issues is not at all if the US will return to that deal or not. Our reasonable and logical demand is the lifting of sanctions.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Sanctions should be lifted. This is a right that has been taken from the Iranian nation, whether by the US or the Europeans, who are tied to the US's apron strings and who follow that country. They're obliged to grant this right to the Iranian nation. Only if sanctions are lifted, will the US's return to the Barjam have a meaning. Of course, there's also the issue of compensations, which is one of our demands and which will be pursued in other phases and stages. However, if sanctions are not supposed to be lifted, then its return to the Barjam might even be to our disadvantage. Not only will it not be to our advantage, but it will also be to our disadvantage. Of course, I have told officials, both in executive and legislative branches, that they should move forward in a careful manner and by observing all the necessary steps. The second point is that the decision by the Majlis and the administration to cancel the Barjam commitments is the right decision. It is a completely reasonable, logical, and acceptable decision.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah.
Around the World with Reporters.
Rome's Association of Palestinians called a sit-in in the vicinity of the Italian parliament to draw attention on Israel's COVID-19 vaccine program, which excludes the nearly 5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip under Israeli military occupation. The rally was supported by a number of left-wing groups and unions.
The fourth Geneva Convention stipulates that Israel has a responsibility as an occupying power to ensure that medical aid reaches the occupied territories to combat the coronavirus crisis. Responsibilities also include providing vaccines in a non-discriminatory manner to Palestinians under its control.
Israel has the duty to provide COVID vaccines to Palestinians. The question is why nobody talks about it here in Italy. TVs and newspapers praise Israel's vaccination campaign, but they don't say a word about how Israel is a militarized country which is not observing its international obligations and pays each vaccine dose double the price, promising pharmaceutical companies patient data.
While Palestinians' right to health care is undermined, Tel Aviv has pledged to send thousands of spare coronavirus vaccines to foreign allies that have accepted Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem, such as Czech Republic, Hungary and Honduras.
These vaccine donations are the latest example of Israel's new expression of soft power. Tel Aviv rewards or sways those that have little access to vaccines in exchange for their complicity. This confirms the absence of morals and values of Israel.
We are calling on Italy, the EU and international community to take concrete measures to force Israel to provide Palestinians with vaccines. We are not begging, we demand what is ours.
In January, the United Nations voiced its concern over Israel's refusal to vaccinate the Palestinians, but the appeal has gone unheard so far. Max Civili, Rome.
Across South Korea, vaccinations against COVID-19 began, with more than 5,000 nursing home residents and care providers scheduled to get their jabs by the end of the day.
I was thinking of the elderly patients at our nursing home who have been exhausted and sad about not being able to see their families, so I'm glad to be the first person to be vaccinated. I hope herd immunity is established so that our patients can see their families and everyone can return to daily life without masks.
President Moon Jae-in observed people getting their shots, seeking to encourage people to be vaccinated when it's their turn. South Korean officials say the country should achieve herd immunity by November of this year. Herd immunity is achieved when a high percentage of people have been immunized, preventing the spread of a contagious disease. But about half of South Koreans surveyed are hesitant to get their shots. South Korea had been successful in limiting the spread of COVID-19 during the initial outbreak a year ago, but has seen waves of the virus infect hundreds of people each day since November last year.
There are many reasons why I will get my shot right away, but I think during the last year of COVID-19, the government has done well to prevent it spreading, so I trust them in terms of the vaccine.
South Korea has received vaccines, but I'm hesitant to get it. It's because in the UK, many cases of side effects have been reported, so I'm a bit reluctant. I want to watch what happens, and I'll get it if it's okay then.
Seoul's November goal of herd immunity may also be complicated by supply chain challenges and drug-resistant variants of COVID-19, with a return to normality more likely in 2022. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The nursery home in the vicinity of Tehran, and people are waiting to receive the first dose of their COVID-19 jab. At this phase, which is the second, the elderly and those with underlying diseases and the disabled will get the vaccine. The country's health minister, Said Namaki, attended the retirement home in Kahrizak to launch the campaign. He told reporters that these people will be vaccinated free of charge.
Unfortunately, today the second phase of corona vaccination began across the country. At this stage, in addition to people working at the ICUs of the hospitals and the more vulnerable ones, the elderly will get the jab. We launched a campaign here at Kahrizak Nursery Home, but as of tomorrow, at most of the nursery centers, this will continue.
Press TV asked the minister when the normal people will take the vaccine, and he answered that hopefully by September, most of the Iranians will be vaccinated.
Based on the priorities, first off the healthcare staff and then the elderly and people with specific diseases, as well as those injured during the Iran-Iraq war, will be inoculated. Afterwards, it comes to the normal people, and I think most of the target groups will get the shot by mid-September.
We also interviewed the head of Iran's welfare organization, who told us that in the first stage, some 20,000 doses will be allocated to nursery centers across the country.
Over 14,000 elderly people are receiving services at nursery homes across Iran. Out of them, over 3,000 were infected, but some 2,200 got well, 506 people are under treatment, and unfortunately, 375 ones lost their lives despite our efforts. At this center, 1,400 aged and disabled people will be vaccinated within 2 days.
The Islamic Republic kicked off the first phase of COVID-19 vaccination with administering the jab on medical staff working at some 600 hospitals across the country. Iranian health officials say indigenously produced shots will be used in the later stages of the campaign. Over 110,000 people have been vaccinated up to now. Iran has so far logged more than 1.6 million COVID-19 cases with over 59,800 deaths.
Iran began its COVID-19 vaccination program on February 9th. The top priority group of vaccination are doctors and nurses who are working at intensive care units of the hospitals. The next group are these elderly people and the ones with underlying diseases. Human Abedi, Kahrizak.
Venezuela's Congress, also known as the National Assembly, has requested the government of President Nicolas Maduro to expel European Union Ambassador Isabel Brillante out of the South American nation as a diplomatic action countering the recently launched sanctions from the EU against the Bolivarian Republic. The Maduro administration has denounced the European measures, describing them as illegal and harmful to the economy of Venezuela. Venezuelan officials say that the EU, along with the U.S. government, are plotting to produce a humanitarian crisis in the Latin American country in order to bring down President Nicolas Maduro. Although a UN human rights envoy recently declared foreign sanctions on Venezuela have no legal basis and must be lifted, the EU has ratified its decision. Venezuelan authorities claim they will legally confront the sanctions.
Okay, van 34 meses.
The EU, just like the US, is criminally targeting Venezuela. However, this unfair aggression will not oust Maduro.
Meanwhile, in the opposition, some say elections in Venezuela would ease the elimination of sanctions.
If free elections were held here, all foreign sanctions would blow over, but Maduro refuses to do so.
Nonetheless, socialists insist that neither the EU nor the US can judge what free elections are.
We have already had free elections guaranteed by many foreign observers, so the EU and the US are lying for political purposes.
Caracas slams the EU over violating international law with illegal sanctions. The expelling of the European ambassador is widely seen as a response to the bloc's economic policies against Venezuela.